Volume 4, Chapter 9, The Invasion of Canada. While Washington busied himself with crippling the morale of the American army before Boston, other American forces were not idle. We have seen that promptly upon seizing Fort Ticonderoga and Crown Point, Ethan Allen and Benedict Arnold both pressed upon Congress the urgency of seizing the northern British base in Canada. They realized the necessity of speed. The British commander in Canada, General Guy Carleton, his troops depleted to aid General Gage in Boston, had only 2 foot regiments and 2 artillery companies to defend the entire region. Speed was also needed to take advantage of spring and summer weather. There were Americans who supported a prompt strike at the British base in Canada. For instance, one of the spark plugs of the blow at Ticonderoga had been John Brown, a lawyer of Pittsfield, Massachusetts, who had been sent as early as February as a secret agent to the Canadians by the Boston Committee of Correspondence to whip up support for the colonial cause. But we have seen that the conservatives in the Congress timorously scuttled the plan and even tried to get the Americans to withdraw from Ticonderoga. They even went so far as to drive the bold and brilliant Arnold and Allen from command. The discontented activist officers at Ticonderoga quickly reacted by sending Ethan Allen and Seth Warner of the Green Mountain Boys as emissaries to the Continental Congress. Apparently, Congress found Allen persuasive, for it promptly recommended to the New York Provincial Congress that it form the Green Mountain Boys into a ranger regiment with officers of their own choosing. Moreover, 4 days later, on June 27, Congress finally decided to authorize an invasion of Canada. While the Americans essentially adopted Arnold's tactical plan of taking Montreal and then moving on to Quebec, Congress, of course, did not have the imagination or daring to place such brilliant military radicals as Arnold or Allen in charge of the expedition against Canada. Instead, command was given to the man already in charge of the Northern Department at New York, the timorous and conservative scion of the New York landed oligarchy, Philip Schuyler. At a time when speed was of the essence, Schuyler dithered for 2 precious months, preparing his army of 1,700 men to move north from Crown Point and Ticonderoga. Fortunately, Schuyler had as his second in command the highly competent Brigadier General Richard Montgomery, who recognized the need for speed in mounting the invasion. The British-born Montgomery had had almost as much military experience in Europe as his friend Charles Lee or Horatio Gates, and had resigned from the British Army in 1772 to settle in New York and marry into the Livingston branch of the New York landed aristocracy. In vain did he press Schuyler to march north. Finally, taking advantage of Schuyler's absence at a parley to secure the neutrality of the Iroquois, Montgomery took it upon himself to make the move against Canada at the end of August, a decision in which Schuyler, taken off the hook, readily concurred. General Carleton decided to make his main stand at Fort St. John's on the Richelieu River, north of Lake Champlain. But Schuyler lingered defensively in front of St. John's for 2 weeks, and only his illness, forcing him to return south in mid-September, permitted Montgomery to surround and lay proper siege to the fort. The great bulk of the American expeditionary force came from Connecticut, the conservative province of New York, as Connecticut's Colonel Hinman said sourly, abounds with officers, but I have not had my curiosity gratified by the sight of one private. While this proved to be a slight exaggeration, the New Englanders were understandably aggrieved at seeing the New Yorkers fill the major post and gain lucrative commissary contracts while they furnished the fighting men. The New Hampshire grant contribution, in the meanwhile, had been gravely crippled by an upheaval among the Green Mountain Boys. Acceding to Congress's request, the New York Provincial Congress, in early July, had agreed to raise a battalion of 500 men from the grant lands, to be known as the Green Mountain Rangers. But when the Committee of Safety of the towns west of the Green Mountains assembled at Dorset at the end of July to elect officers of the new battalion, Allen was humiliatingly repudiated. Seth Warner was chosen to be commander, and Allen was not even selected as one of the subordinate officers. The brutal cashiering of the magnificent Allen had been accomplished not by his devoted Green Mountain Boys, but by the timorous town elders of the Grant Lands, who hated the radical, brawling, zestful deist, and took this opportunity to scuttle him. The enraged young men of the Grant Lands thereupon refused to enlist, and Warner was not able to bring the battalion to more than half strength. Deprived of their leader and their enthusiasm, the Green Mountain men were no longer the superbly effective force they once had been. Allen, however, swallowed his pride in his eagerness to aid the revolutionary cause, and went back to Ticonderoga in hope of a commission. But Schuyler scornfully allowed the hero of Ticonderoga to sign on only as a private. At the siege of St. John's, General Montgomery put Allen in charge of 30 Connecticut militiamen and sent him off through the countryside between the Richelieu and Montreal to try to raise Canadian volunteers for the cause. John Brown, now a major, and Warner were also sent around the countryside on similar errands. Repeatedly urging Montgomery to seize St. John's without delay, Allen managed to raise about 80 Canadians. On September 24, Allen encountered Brown near Longueuil, across the St. Lawrence from Montreal. Brown's bold proposal to strike at Montreal with his force of 200 had been vetoed by Montgomery. So he joined with Allen in a daring plan for a joint surprise strike at that great Canadian port. They agreed upon an immediate coordinated attack, Brown to cross the river and approach the city from the north, and Allen, his force now grown to 150, to attack simultaneously from the south. The plan was brilliantly conceived and rested on the mobility and surprise inherent in a guerrilla-style operation. But Brown unaccountably failed to cross the river as agreed. The abandoned Allen was left to face an open battle with a superior force of over 30 British regulars and 200 Canadian volunteers. Furthermore, Allen's men were not trained and loyal Green Mountain Boys, and the Canadians on Allen's flanks fled as soon as the British force surged out of Montreal to do battle. Allen and the tiny remainder of his force were taken prisoner, with Allen placed in chains and transported to England. The Americans' greatest and most daring guerrilla fighter was removed from the scene. Washington, who was wont to defend and wet-nurse his fellow oligarch, Schuyler, could only react with near satisfaction to the loss of Allen. Colonel Allen's misfortune will, I hope, teach a lesson of prudence and subordination to others. The population of Canada in 1775 numbered approximately 60,000, almost all of them French peasants, or habitants, oppressed alike by the British state-privileged seigneurs and by the state-privileged church. There were only several hundred English Canadians, old subjects, most of them bureaucrats, soldiers, and merchants engaged in the Montreal fur trade. Naturally, as the Revolutionary War began, both the British and the Americans tried to woo the Canadians. Equally naturally, the French Canadians, certain of English and American contempt for their religion and their ethnic origins, had little interest in either party and remained neutral and aloof. Had the Anglo-American record of racial and religious bigotry not prevented the French Canadians from joining the revolutionary cause, Canada, Quebec, would undoubtedly have become a 14th original state of the United States. The capture of Ethan Allen had considerable influence in swaying the cautious Canadians and Canadian Indians toward what looked like the winning side. But Carleton quickly dissipated any goodwill among the habitants by trying to conscript them en masse into the army, a draft that the sturdy French refused to obey. 900 new men, thus conscripted swiftly, deserted at a rate of nearly 40 a day. The weather was now turning cold. The many months of American delay were already beginning to take their toll. The heavy New England force was also irrepressibly asserting its individuality and was in a state near to total mutiny. Montgomery's orders were being blithely disregarded, and he perceptively testified to the libertarian spirit of his troops, complaining to Schuyler that it was impossible to command men who carried the spirit of freedom into the field and think for themselves. In short, the privates are all generals. Things had begun to look up for the American forces, however. Montgomery's kinsman, Colonel James Livingston, managed to maneuver past St. John's and capture Fort Chambly, some miles to the north, on October 8. St. John's was now in grave peril, and Carleton raised a rescue force of 60 regulars and over 700 allied Indians and set forth across the St. Lawrence. But Seth Warner and the Green Mountain Rangers had fortified the opposite bank at Longueuil. Their fire beat back the British. The doomed Fort St. John's surrendered on November 2, and 500 regulars, the bulk of the British force in Canada, were taken prisoner. The great victory at St. John's threw Montreal wide open to the American forces, and General Montgomery swiftly pressed his advantage. Carleton escaped with his 150 regulars downriver toward Quebec, the last British stronghold in Canada. On November 13, a citizens' committee surrendered Montreal to the American force. At this point, there occurred another of the near misses at victory that were to stud this campaign. Carleton's fleet, sailing down the St. Lawrence, reached American positions at Sorel, at the junction of the Richelieu and St. Lawrence rivers. Major John Brown managed to dupe the British into believing that great cannon were stationed at Sorel, thus convincing the British fleet to surrender on November 19. Canada could have been conquered then and there. But the redoubtable Carleton slipped past the American lines, disguised in peasant costume, and managed to reach Quebec. He reached Quebec just in time for the British cause. The Americans had decided to strike on two fronts. While Schuyler and Montgomery were to make for Montreal, another force was to march overland across an extremely rugged route through Maine, following the Kennebec, Dead, and Chaudière rivers to assault Quebec. The daring plan for the expedition had been drawn up by the restless Benedict Arnold, who, having won the support of General Gates, was selected by Washington to lead the expedition with the rank of colonel. The plan was a brilliant one, and Arnold was happily given a free hand. But time was growing short. The decision to go forward with the invasion was made in mid-August, and General Winter was near at hand. There was no dearth of volunteers for the Arnold expedition from the bored and fretting troops in the army around Boston. The assembled force of over 1,000 men consisted of 10 companies of musketeers from New England and 3 companies of backwoods riflemen from Virginia and Pennsylvania. Working at breakneck speed, Arnold was able to assemble the troops at Cambridge on September 11. They set sail for the Kennebec from Newburyport, Massachusetts, on the 19th, reaching Gardiner on the 22nd. Arnold now organized his army into four divisions, the lead division of riflemen under the command of Captain Daniel Morgan, head of the Virginia Rifle Company. It was Morgan's task to clear a path for the army through the wilderness over the numerous carrying places. This giant, burly frontiersman, teamster, and veteran Indian fighter was to prove to be the great guerrilla fighter of the Revolutionary War. Overcoming incredible difficulties and hardships, Arnold and Morgan led their men to Quebec in one of the most famous marches in history, ranked by many with Xenophon's. But tragically, Lieutenant Colonel Roger Enos, in charge of the rearguard division, decided to betray his post at the end of October and took his force back home, absconding also with the bulk of the scarce remaining food. Enos's defection subtracted 300 crucial men from the expedition, a loss that might well have spelled the difference between victory and defeat. Still, Arnold and his gallant 700 might have taken Quebec. They arrived at Point Levis, across the St. Lawrence from Quebec, on November 9. The city was weakly defended, and a quick thrust across the river could have meant its capture. But high winds forced fatal delays in the crossing, allowing the Highland Scot, Alan MacLean, who by sheer accident had learned of the Arnold expedition, to reach Quebec with 100 men before Arnold could mount his attack. Finally, crossing on November 13, Arnold tried to provoke MacLean to leave the walls and fight, as Montcalm had done against the British over a dozen years before. MacLean sat tight. So Arnold, lacking men for a siege, went upriver to Point aux Trembles to wait for Montgomery. But the months of delay were now taking their toll, and the terms of enlistment of Montgomery's troops were about up. He was left with only 800 men, and after leaving garrisons at St. John's and Montreal, he could join Arnold with only 300, making a total American force of 1,000 before Quebec. Montgomery and Arnold now found themselves besieging a city where 1,800 men had been mobilized, and with soldiers whose terms of service expired at the end of the year. The Americans were therefore forced to strike quickly, but the number of men was now too few, and the decision for coordinated surprise attack by the two leaders was betrayed to the enemy by deserters. Two columns struck at Quebec on the night of December 30. Trying desperately to rally his column, the gallant Montgomery was cut down. The rest of the force promptly retreated in a rout, despite efforts of the brilliant young volunteer, Captain Aaron Burr, son of the president of the College of New Jersey at Princeton, to rally the troops. The collapse of the Montgomery column left the British free to concentrate on Colonel Arnold's force. Arnold was wounded in the attack, but Morgan, taking command, braved countless bullets and crashed the barrier. Morgan's every instinct was to strike while the iron was hot and the British were in panic. But unfortunately, he complied with the advice of his officers against any further advance. If not for this timorousness, which Arnold would certainly have overridden, Morgan might well have seized all of Lower Quebec. The delay proved fatal. Now surrounded by the British, the undauntable Morgan offered to personally cut a swath through the British troops to gain an escape route, but the other officers refused. Instead, they decided to surrender. Morgan, completely alone and personally surrounded, steadfastly refused to surrender until the very end. The Battle of Quebec had been absolutely disastrous for the Americans, and most of the finest leaders in the American army were put out of commission. Allen had been captured. The great Montgomery was dead. Morgan was captured, and Arnold was gravely wounded. The brave Kennebec marchers were wiped out, with 100 casualties and 400 taken prisoner. Even so, Arnold, now a brigadier general, issuing orders from the hospital bed, refused to give up, and his few hundred half-starved men lay futile siege to Quebec for the rest of the winter. For his noble efforts, Arnold once again received mainly humiliation. He had asked for Charles Lee or someone like him to take command and lead the assault, but when reinforcements came in early April 1776, he was replaced by craven commanders who abandoned the siege. Now he moved disconsolately behind the lines to take charge of the occupation of Montreal. At this strategic moment, in early May 1776, Carleton surged forth from Quebec with 900 men to rout the American forces. In early June, New Hampshire's General John Sullivan was appointed commander of the forces in Canada. Sullivan was as bold as Arnold and Montgomery, but lacked their brains. Now that strategic retreat was called for, Sullivan, on June 7, rashly launched an attack against the town of Three Rivers on the St. Lawrence. The result was collapse. 200 Americans, including the leader of the actual attack, General William Thompson, commander of one of the Pennsylvania Rifle Regiments, were taken prisoner. Faced with the crushing defeat at Three Rivers, Sullivan had had enough, and he proceeded to beat a hasty and ignominious retreat. Rushing back from Canada and abandoning all positions there, the American forces returned to Ticonderoga in early July 1776. Thus ended the American push against Canada, a tragic and disastrous failure. Yet few campaigns in military history have been so marked by so many hairline turning points, the delays of Congress and of Schuyler, bringing on winter weather and the end of American enlistment terms, the failure of Brown to meet Allen, the melodramatic escape of the formidable General Carleton from capture by the Americans, the decimation of Montgomery's army by the end of enlistment terms, the desertion by Colonel Enos, the high winds delaying Arnold's crossing of the St. Lawrence, the accidental discovery by MacLean of Arnold's advance, the hasty attack on Quebec impelled by the end of enlistment terms, the killing of General Montgomery and the subsequent rout of his column, the wounding of Arnold and subsequent hobbling of Morgan's advance, and the replacement of Arnold the following spring. Some of the most daring and progressive leaders, those most sensitive to guerrilla-type warfare, had been lost. Allen, Morgan, Montgomery, Thompson. The inordinately expensive campaign had succeeded in losing 5,000 American troops to death and capture. And Canada was lost forever.